So, as you doubtless know, tonight our theme is God at the Movies. And I've been preaching on particular films here at St. Paul's since 2005. Starting with Harry Potter and The Da Vinci Code. And over the years, I've picked on a particular film or sometimes a particular book and said, well, what does this say to us? But tonight I'm not doing that. I'm going back to basics, really, and thinking about the bigger picture. Because I want us to think, when I'm sitting at home watching a film, or indeed when I'm at the cinema, caught up in the experience of the big screen, and this works equally truly for TV series and for books as well, but I think there is something particularly powerful and captivating about a film, particularly if we're in the cinema with the lights down, we are drawn in a way that perhaps we're not sitting with a book. I mean, we might be. Or a TV series, because of the length, because of the intensity often. And I want us to think, do we ever think that actually, I've put a picture of a sofa with two spaces, because do we actually think that God is sitting there beside us? And if we suddenly, in the middle of the film, did think that God's sitting there beside us, what would we do? I'd quickly press pause, or off. And I want to suggest that the three key questions, these are the ones I always seek to address when I'm talking about a film, are these. Firstly, what is this film or book or TV series or whatever saying? It's got a message. What is that message? Secondly, and I'll talk about that a bit more in a moment, what's it saying about the big questions, about life with a capital L, about God, about humanity, about society? And of course, the very fact that God is never, ever mentioned might be saying something about God, that God is irrelevant, that God is unimportant. But then thirdly, what is God saying about this film? What does God think about what I'm watching? And obviously, particularly, I'm talking tonight about films, and most of my references, nearly all my references, will be about films. So what is this film saying? Let me give an example. Sometimes it's really obvious. So I'm sorry Paul Vallis isn't here tonight, because he lent me years ago this film, Glory, and I said I'd watch it, but I knew that Heather wouldn't want to watch it, so I had to wait to be on my own. So I only got round to it this year, and the message is fairly clear. Recently, Heather and I watched the film Lincoln, the biography that I'm pretty sure won Daniel Day-Lewis an Oscar for his performance. So he certainly was Oscar nominated for it. And the message of that is fairly similar too. And I haven't seen the film Hidden Figures. Heather wanted to buy it on DVD and take it on holiday with us, but it hasn't come out yet. It's not out until July the 3rd. But I'm pretty sure that the message of all three films is pretty much the same. And that is that African-Americans, in fact, every minority, every person of every race and colour and background is equal. That it is wrong to discriminate, that it has been horrendously wrong the way that African-Americans have been treated. And that now we recognise that that was an injustice and we need to act differently and think differently. Now, you do not need to have studied a PhD in film and media studies to get that message from any of those films. It's pretty obvious. So that's the sort of first level. But interestingly, sometimes films stray into asking bigger questions about society, about humanity, about God. And I was deeply depressed when I heard that Hollywood had made the film Bruce Almighty, where Jim Carrey gets all God's powers. I thought, oh, this is going to be so awful, and as a Christian, it's going to do so much damage to people's perceptions of what Christianity is all about. So I didn't go and see it at the cinema, and I waited until it was out on DVD, and I thought, oh, actually, this is really rather interesting. This is really rather thought-provoking. So for those of you who haven't seen it, we're just going to see a very short clip. What happens is that God gives Bruce, who is a local reporter, all his powers. This one's quite loud, Ian, I know that. They're all slightly different sound levels, these clips. So I apologise, but it might wake Peter Watson up, who's been up all night.
And he saw that it was good. world.
So, what's Bruce going to do with all this power? And that's the big question. And what I thought was so remarkable, I recommend it to anyone to watch, because the portrayal, particularly of Bruce's girlfriend, isn't she? She's not his wife, can't remember. Anyway, Jennifer Aniston, is a remarkably sympathetic portrayal of a Christian. You know, you watch, and the fact that she's Jennifer Aniston is doing good things already, saying, you know, ooh, you know, Jennifer Aniston's a Christian, ooh. It's actually a very understanding and positive portrayal of what Christians are, unlike many films and books and caricatures in the media. So that was good. Some of the questions it looks like so what do you do with people's prayers? And at one point in the film, Bruce answers everyone's prayers yes, and total chaos results, mayhem results. And so, if you stop and think about it, that's why God doesn't answer all prayers yes. Because, for example, everyone wins the lottery, and so they win kind of $2.50. And that makes them really angry. It's interesting what you do with those sort of issues. Then the big issue that it comes out with is Bruce's great frustration is that he cannot make his girlfriend or wife, whichever it is, can't remember, Jennifer Aniston, his partner, Jennifer Aniston, love him. And he complains to God, you know, what? This is no good if I can't make someone love me. And God says, basically, welcome to my world. You know, that, it's very thought-provoking. And then the director made a sequel. So this time I was keen to watch Evan Almighty, where Steve Carroll is basically taken over by the spirit of Noah. But I was quite disappointed with that. I thought, it's not as good. He's just making a sequel to make more money because the first one did really well. But then I saw an interview with the director, and what he said was really fascinating. He said, what I wanted to do was make the total contrast to Bruce Almighty, because in Bruce's case, he gets all God's power. He is almighty. Literally. In Evan's case, what I do is show what happens when a man is stripped of all his power, of all his dignity, of all that he holds dear. What does he look like then? And I thought, wow, I will look at this film with completely different eyes now. I mean, I don't actually think that he does it as well, because it has a slightly cheesy ending, which doesn't relate to that in the way that the Bruce film works. But it does change my perspective and think, oh, okay, you're trying to do something clever here, which is well worth thinking about. So do you see that actually sometimes it's really not hard to ask that question, what is this film saying about life, God, humanity, and what does God think about this film? It only requires a little thought and perhaps a fascinating family discussion. And then I want to give you a little insight into the afterlife. Because there are some fascinating films from recent years about the afterlife. I saw this appalling film I would just like to put out there. Don't watch Up There. It was on one of the four channels, and I recorded it and watched it, thankfully, without Heather. And it shows these two guys who've died and who are in the afterlife, and they welcome people who've just died into this new world, which is pretty much like the old one, only duller. And it says on the screen, caring in the afterlife is a dead-end job, and that's the message you get. And I just thought, and it's kind of set, you get the feeling it's sort of set in a Glasgow council estate. It's grim. And you thought, is that really what our society thinks about life after death, that it's just going to be like this one, only duller? And it reminded me of a fascinating Norwegian film. They do these things slightly weirder, which is the same sort of message. So a guy dies and finds himself in another world, and it's quite clearly set as another world. And what becomes apparent is that this other world, this life after death, although it seems as if it has the same opportunities and excitements as this life. It has food to eat, it has relationships to have. Yet actually, it's all slightly grey. And the food doesn't really taste of anything. I mean, there's humour in it. He has a dinner party and they all get very excited, because it's a Norwegian film, about IKEA catalogues and about what furniture they're going to buy, which is, you know, poking fun at the Swedes. But there's one amazing moment in it where he meets a man who has a hole in his cellar wall, and the man says, "I can hear stuff through the smell at the cellar wall." And they start digging and burrowing their way through the cellar wall. And you'll see the moment when he breaks through. And what lies the other side? From, remember, this is a dull grey world where nothing satisfies, nothing fulfills, neither food nor work nor leisure nor indeed sex. Nothing fulfills. And then he breaks through.
They looked at home.
The other thing I should mention is there are no children in the world after life. So in the place he sees, I think, you know, is it the it looked like Provence, didn't it, or something like that? And you think, is it the Norwegian yearning for a holiday in the sun? But it's conveying the idea that there's somewhere with the sound of children playing, with beautiful tastes and scents, with colour. But you can't get it. It's just beyond your reach. And I'd love to know, I don't know what the filmmaker was thinking when he made that, but the thing is, the men in grey suits then come and get him and drag him back. And he's back in the grey world again. And they're always around, the men in grey suits. And you think, is that your life without God? That you think, well, there must be something more than this. There must be something out there, but I don't actually ever get it. I taste it for a moment and then it's gone. It's a fascinating reflection on our society. And here's another view of the afterlife from Harry Potter, the last book. It's very quiet all the way through, but they don't say anything for a while.
Professor, what is that?
Something beyond either of our hope. A part of Voldemort sent here to die.
And exactly where are we?
I was going to ask you that. Where would you say that we are?
Well, it looks like King's Cross Station. Only cleaner. And without all the trains.
King's Cross, is that right? This is, as they say, your party.
Now, I find it fascinating and very suggestive that the place where Harry goes to when he dies, in inverted commas, a place from which he can return back to this life, a place where he meets Dumbledore, who has died, a place, therefore, of resurrection, is called King's Cross. For a Christian, that's kind of suggestive, as we worship someone who is the king who died on a cross. And whether I'm reading too much into it, I don't know. But it's an odd choice for a place, if not. And the fact is that throughout the Harry Potter books, there is strong Christian symbolism. And J.K. Rowling herself has said, yes, that is deliberate, that is conscious. And the whole thing is a battle of good against evil. And I have done assembly series next door at St. Paul's on book one, book two, and book four. Even though I realised this weekend that book four is a 12, so that's probably not a good idea, but the clips I show are all very PG. And there is such, I mean, it's such a gift to a preacher. There is such a strong Christian message that comes across through these books, book one in particular. So I'm going to show you a slightly grainier clip from the end of Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, when Harry has defeated the evil Lord Voldemort. So it's a spoiler if you haven't read book one. He is thinking about what has happened and how he has survived an attack which he thought would have killed him.
Good afternoon, Harry.
Ah, tokens from your admirers?
Admirers?
What happened down in the dungeons between you and Professor Quirrell is a complete secret. So, naturally, the whole school knows. Ah, I see that your friend Ronald has saved you the trouble of opening your chocolate frogs.
Ron was here. Is he all right? What about Hermione?
Fine. They're both just fine.
But what happened to the stone?
Relax, dear boy. The stone has been destroyed. My friend Nicholas and I have had a little chat and agreed it was best all around.
But then Flamel, he'll die, won't he?
He has enough elixir to set his affairs in order. But yes, he will die.
How is it I got the stone, sir? 1 minute I was staring in the mirror, and the next.
You see, only a person who wanted to find the stone, find it, but not use it, would be able to get it. That is one of my more brilliant ideas. And between you and me, that is saying something.
Does that mean, with the stone gone, that is, that Voldemort can never come back?
Ah, I'm afraid there are ways in which he can return. Harry, do you know why Professor Quirrell couldn't bear to have you touch him? It was because of your mother. She sacrificed herself for you. And that kind of act leaves a mark. No, no. This kind of mark cannot be seen. It lives in your very skin.
What is it?
Love, Harry. Love.
Ah, Bertie Bott's Every Flavor Beans. I was most unfortunate in my youth to come across a vomit-flavored one. And since then, I'm afraid, I've lost my liking for them. But I think I could be safe with a nice toffee. Mmm. A lot. Earwax.
I just left the last bit in as a joke, you know, to liven things up. But do you see what a gift that is to a Christian preacher? Harry, there is a power that protects you, a mark that is on you. It is the power of sacrificial love, which evil cannot understand, and leaves you with a mark. No, not a visible mark, but one that guards you and protects you. As a Christian, you have a mark on your forehead, which is the sign of the cross that is made over you when you are baptized. I mean, it's a gift, isn't it? But some would say, well, hang on a minute, because what you're doing is you're hijacking secular films and you are inserting into them your Christian message, which actually isn't there at all. I mean, it's debatable whether it is with J.K. Rowling, but what gives you the right to do that, to kind of twist these things and see a Christian message there? Well, that's where our reading comes in. Because Paul does exactly that in Athens. Paul is talking to a group of pagans, people who do not believe in the resurrection of Jesus, haven't heard of Jesus, and who worship, he says, you worship an unknown God. Well, I'm here to tell you, I know that God, and I want to tell you who he is. And what he does then is, fascinatingly, he quotes two pagan poets. The first one he doesn't say is a quotation from one of your pagan poets, but it is. In him we live and move and have our being. And so he says, I know in your literature, your pagan literature, your God-worshipping but not my God-worshipping literature, this is what you say about God. So we see that you're looking for him, you're searching after him, but that's the wrong place to look. You won't find him in your altar. I'm here to tell you, you'll find him in Jesus. That's the good news. So Paul does exactly what I'm doing. He takes something they know and love and that says, there's more to life than this. There's something beyond this, and says, you don't know what it is. Like the guy in The Bothersome Man, you're looking for something, you can't quite reach it, but I can tell you what it is. It's real, it's true, and it works. So I think it's perfectly justifiable and perfectly okay, unless it's obviously contrary to what the filmmaker is trying to say, in which case we have to be honest and say, he's saying this, but I'm actually saying no, that. So as we look at these key questions, sometimes as a Christian I have to say, that's wrong. I disagree profoundly with that film because what it's saying is wrong in terms of my Christian faith. And over the years, I've picked out one or two of these, but you may not have been there, and they were a long time ago, so I've forgotten them, so I'm sure you have too. So, for example, Saving Private Ryan made me very angry. I preached on that on Remembrance Sunday in 2009. And it's a film which is, I believe, based on a true event in World War II, where a group of soldiers were sent to rescue the last member of a family. The other sons had all been killed, and this was the last one, and therefore the president said, well, he should be spared to go home to the farm and go back to his mum. And the film has some really positive, good messages. I mean, in a sense, positive in the sense that I think that the message that war is hell, that war is horrendous, that war shatters lives and bodies and is terrible, is a good message, especially on Remembrance Sunday when it can be dressed up and glorified. The message that one life is still important is a really important message. The Talmud, the Jewish prayer book, says, he who saves a single life saves the whole world. That's the message that comes across in Schindler's List. I recently watched a German film called Army of Saviors, which tells the true story of a group of German farmers who hid a Jewish family despite the threat, the constant threat of execution if they were discovered. And, you know, that's an important and powerful message, that the one still counts, even when a world is being torn apart by war. But the thing that made me so cross I actually shouted at the television, which is, for me, for Mrs. Cooten, that's not uncommon, but for me, that's pretty rare. The dying Tom Hanks, who's the head of the leader of the soldiers who've gone to rescue Private Ryan, as he dies, whispers to Private Ryan, who's been rescued, earn this. And at the end of the film, you come to the present day, and Private Ryan is now a grown-up with his children and grandchildren, and he's standing in a cemetery looking at the tomb of the deceased captain and says, have I been a good man? Have I done enough to earn this? And you think, that is the most appalling burden to place on anyone, that you've got to spend the whole of your rest of your life earning the death of somebody else who's died for you. And everything that we stand for as Christians says, you can never be good enough. You will kill yourself trying to be good enough. You will beat yourself up every day if you think, I've got to be perfect. I've got to be good enough to justify someone dying for me. You can't do it. All you can do is say, I am so grateful. I will live out of gratitude for what you have done. So yeah, I think that's a burden too heavy to bear. And I thought it's such a shame that that film is shown again and again to sort of model the sacrifice of our brave soldiers, because it preaches entirely the wrong message, a message that's too hard for people. And then you know, I love James Bond. I preached on Skyfall. I preached very positively about Skyfall because it was the most, I don't know if it's been overtaken since, but it was the most popular, best-selling British film of all time when it came out. It grossed more at the box office. More people went to see it than any other film before it, which was amazing in this country. But the fact is, when I'm watching James Bond, and I have seen them all, and I do enjoy them, I find myself at a certain point in the film going, either out loud or in my head, shoot, shoot, get him! Won't you get him? And, you know, if I think of God sitting there beside me and saying, kill somebody, you know, probably that's not such a good thing. You know, there are bracelets people wear, WWJD. That's not what would James do. You know, that's what would Jesus do. And the fact is, I mean, Bond, we kind of think, well, it's fantasy, you know, people don't really, we don't really have spooks who act like that. But the fact is, it's symptomatic. There's a huge genre of violent films which do have that message. On the plane to America, I saw the film Taken. Realised after I got back, they'd obviously cut a lot out of it to show it on the film. Because it's a very violent, brutal film. They've made four of them now, with each time Liam Neeson basically taking on the world and trying to kill as many people as he can to get whoever it is back. The first one was his daughter. And this is the message. I don't know who you are. I don't know what you want. But if you don't let my daughter go, I will find you. I will kill you. And the message is, it is right to take violence into your own hands. It is right to kill other people in order to get what you want. And that's the subliminal message that's coming across. And I think, you know, if enough young men watch enough films like this, they will become more violent. There are studies that show that. But what's even more scary is that in America, lots of people have got guns. And so actually really do start behaving like this. This is a bumper sticker that I photographed when we were in holiday in America. We're pro-God, pro-gun, pro-life. Well, I get pro-God and I get pro-life. And they kind of seem to me to contradict the one in the middle. You know, yes, I'm absolutely pro-life. That means not killing people with a gun. But there you go. And it's important that we recognise that there are films out there, and we can easily get sucked into watching them, especially us guys, that desensitise us to violence, and where we think, yeah, you know, shoot them, get them. And the scary thing is that when I saw a documentary about a group of squaddies in Afghanistan, you know, they play a lot of violent video games. They watch a lot of violent films. They get into the way of thinking, yeah, get the Taliban, shoot as many as you can, which is not actually what the mission's all about. And just a little reflection. It's very interesting to me that in Harry Potter and in the Hunger Games books, which have been so incredibly popular, sold in their millions, and have been read by so many young people and teenagers, and adults too, for a guilty pleasure, Harry and his friends do not use killing curses. They use binding curses and stunning curses. They do not inflict, except in a moment where it's a temptation to do that, they do not inflict death on others. They defend themselves. And in the same way, in The Hunger Games, which are a series of books about a teenage girl who's put through the most horrendous suffering and has to fight and kill other young people in order to survive. That's the Hunger Games. It's based on the Roman arena, where these teenagers are put in competition against one another and only one is allowed to survive. She always defends herself. Katniss does not seek to destroy and kill the other contestants. She just seeks to defend herself. But as the films and the books go on, it gets harder and harder to have untainted, clean hands. And Suzanne Collins, who's written them, says that she knows this, she's aware of this, and that when she was a young girl, her father went to Vietnam and fought in Vietnam. And he made it very clear to his children that war is not only brutal and bloody, but also complicated. And that sometimes good people have to do bad things for a good end. So, you know, it's good. We need to make a judgment. You know, this is a film that's got violence in it, but is that actually a kind of an okay violence, or is that a negative, destructive violence? And of course, the other thing about James Bond is if you're not saying shoot her, you're going, oh, kiss her, even though she's married to somebody else. And again, in everyday life, you probably wouldn't be encouraging that in your vicar. But there is, again, this subliminal message that comes across again and again in so many books, in so many films, in so many magazines, that if you are not having a very active sex life with all sorts of people, you are a sad loser. And we are big fans of the American TV series, The Big Bang Theory, just as we were of Friends, from which it is taken over, really, in terms of the huge sums that its stars are paid and the number of times it's on every day on television. But the message is the same, that if you're on your own, you are a sad loser. You should be in a relationship with somebody, but particularly, whether you're in a relationship or not, you should be having sex with somebody. And so that's the message that our young people, our teenagers, are getting again and again and again from their screens, whether we want them to or not. And that's not what the film's about, or the in this case, the TV series is about. You know, it's about entertainment. It's about relationships. It's about friends. But that's the subliminal message that's coming across. And we need to be asking the question of ourselves and of our families, what does God think about this? And it's still okay to enjoy, but we have to think, well, but that bit of it we don't agree with. That bit we think is wrong. And interestingly, because these questions are profound questions about things that we have different opinions over, we might sometimes differ. Now, I just put in the corner 15. I'm not recommending you watch this film if you are under 15. But a friend of ours said, and I'm not going to say who it was, as you'll see in a moment, said, you should really preach on this film, because it's a really great film. And so Heather and I watched it when our daughter Pippa wasn't there, because Pippa said, oh, no, it's way too embarrassing. You really shouldn't watch that film. So we watched it when she wasn't there. And I thought, no, I really don't like this film. And it's the story of someone who has a rich, successful friend who's having the wedding to end all weddings, and how she not only feels dowdy and left out and on the shelf, but also actually tries to sabotage her friend's successful, very expensive wedding. And there's lots of humour and comedy on the way. But I said to my friend, but she gets a guy in the end. So doesn't that undo all the good message about you don't have to be rich, successful, and with somebody to be happy? And she said, oh, no, but that's not the point. The point is that the main protagonist is not rich, is not successful, has a chaotic life and is messed up, but is still happy. And I thought, I wonder. That's not how I see it, because I think it shoots itself in the foot at the end. So I went on the fount of all wisdom for films, which is IMDb, it's the website, where thousands of people give their views and reviews. And it's really interesting to look up Bridesmaids, because it either gets 9 out of 10 or 10 out of 10, or 1 out of 10 and 2 out of 10. Hardly anyone sort of goes for 5 or 6. It's like Marmite, you know. I love this film. Even guys loved it. Oh, I hated this film. Tear up your ticket. Don't go and see it. And this is what one of the people said. And I actually agree with this person. A lot of rom-coms, including this one, are pushing a social view that if you're fat, single, or unmarried, you are weird, low in confidence, and a failure. Wedding parties in films are also now so extravagantly realised that they've become a measure of success and social approval. Bridesmaids continues many of these trends, taking every chance to deprive its characters of dignity. That is, until Annie can find the ridiculously nice Irish bloke. So it tries to have its cake and eat it. And to me, that's what comes across. That unless you are slim, married, and successful, you're weird, low in confidence, and a failure. So those are the questions I think it's really good to ask. What is this film saying? What, in particular, what's it saying about life, God, and humanity? And what does God think about this film? And it won't surprise you to know, those who have been with me over the years, that the two films that I most enjoy, apart from Bruce Almighty, that make me think theologically, what does this film say about God, are The Truman Show, which is a film about somebody who's on television all the time, but unaware of it. And the question is, will he stay in this perfect world, a world where everything is done for him, or will he break free? And it's a picture, and this is deliberately theological. The person who's overseeing the whole thing is called Christu. He is called True Man. I mean, please, people, it's not hard to spot what's being flagged up here. But the point is, he breaks free. He doesn't want everything, all the strings pulled for him to have the perfect life. He wants freedom. And when you think, why doesn't God answer my prayers? That's a very interesting question to reflect. If God gave you everything you asked for, would it actually lead to freedom? Or would it lead to a prison? And we haven't got time to show two film clips from it. Because the one I want to finish on is The Adjustment Bureau, which again is a rom-com, but has this really, I didn't speak about it very long ago, so I'm not going to show any clips on that either, but it says that there is a plan for our life. We have free will. It's a similar sort of message, but slightly different. And God can change his plan. So for both of those films, yes, you can watch them as a comedy, and you might like them or not like them, but it's really interesting to watch them theologically and think, what does this say about my faith? And do I agree with it or not? Because you're quite at liberty to disagree with me. That's the great thing about films. They can lead to fascinating family conversations. What does God say about this film? And so often we sit on the couch or we sit in the cinema and we just let it wash over us, and therefore it can mold us or shape us. What I want us to do is to think about what you're watching and think, what does God think about that?